The old way of doing things makes sense for some things, like popcorn at the movies. But the old ways don't make sense if you expect more yield out of your acres, because there's a new way to unlock the full potential of your fields, and it starts when you plant Enlist corn. With four robust trait tolerances, glyphosate and glufosinate, plus 2,4-D choline and FOP, it unleashes ultimate weed control flexibility with multiple modes of action to fight weeds. See what's possible for your fields at enlist.com/corn.
Coming up on this week's show, another long-lost NES game has been found.
Why PSPs are exploding.
And we get the history of horror games with the guys from Terabytes.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends, our sponsor, Bitmap Books. Now, of course, we're going to be talking about horror games on this week's show. Have you seen their book, From Ants to Zombies, covering six decades of video game horror? Now, of course, covering all the big games like Resident Evil and Silent Hill, but also spanning these titles from the 1970s right up to the 2020s, over 70 hardware platforms and more than 130 horror games across 600 beautifully illustrated pages. If you love horror games, definitely check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 747, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for our first podcast of April 2025, flying by and creeping scarily close to the big episode 500. I'm noticing as these numbers shoot up each week.
If we just ignore it, it would never happen. I can't believe we're getting close to 500. It's absolutely mental.
You know what makes me laugh about it? Dan will go, let's not make a big deal out of it. Like, you know, when we're coming up to a big number, because then it puts pressure on us to make sure that we do something big. And then literally like 30 episodes before, Dan would be like, oh, is episode 500 coming?
Under pressure, Joe.
It's the radio presenter inside him, you know. He can't help but, you know, add that teaser in there.
Well, that is coming up end of the year. I think we figured that is going to be around October time. So we'll definitely do something fun to celebrate. Fox, that's a big deal, I think, isn't it? 500 episodes of this show. But before we get there, let's not get ahead of ourselves. We have got a podcast to record this week. And on this week's show, we're going to be talking about Joe's favourite subject. Can you hear the excitement in his voice? Horror games. Now, it's kind of a part two, this interview, because going back to the start of last year, we had Dan Richardson on the podcast. Now, Dan reached out to us back then and he said, I'm working on what is going to be like the ultimate history of the horror game genre, where they, what turned out to be a five-part documentary series called Terabytes. Now, going forward into this year, they're actually out there for people to see, at least the first couple of episodes are, and they're just finishing up the final three. But you actually got a sneak glimpse at the first couple of episodes, and you were blown away by the quality of this. And actually, I did say to the guys in the interview that, you know, I know what a big fan you are of horror games, and if this got your endorsement, then this must be damn good.
Yeah, man. I'm just going to say this, like, I'm not endorsed or anything by this, like, I'm not sponsored or anything like that, but this journey...
No cheeky backhander.
Yeah, no cheeky backhanders or anything like that, but this literally came about. Dan emailed me, God, like you say, well over a year ago, probably a year ago, and just said, you know, can you give it a mention on the show? And I was just like, come on. And then, you know, off the back of that, he emailed me, God, about 2 months ago and said, do you want to have a sneak peek, a couple of episodes? And I was like, absolutely. You know, I don't know what I can and can't say. Obviously, in the interview, the guys give us quite a bit, to be fair, but I don't want to spoil that. But the quality of this is absolutely outstanding. I was blown away by the guests and the interviews that they have on there. You know, obviously many, many, many game developers, but just people from the horror genre as well, famous Hollywood people, etc. Really, really cool insight. And like, I really love the structure of it and how they've done it. They've got the five episodes, each episode being like, the first episode's an hour and a half long, second one's like an hour long.
The first one kind of covers the old games like 3D Monster Maze, Alone in the Dark, and Sinistar, stuff like that. Yeah, the roots of horror.
Enter the survival horror. And then the second episode is Lethal Licenses, where they go through like licensed horror games and the history there as well. So, you know, we thought we'd reach out, and interestingly, a veteran of the Retro Hour now, Richard Moss, who we've had on, gosh, this be his fourth time coming on?
Maybe fifth it could be, actually.
Maybe his fifth time. He's a video game historian. Turns out he is writer and director of Terabytes. Mm. And then he brought on Connor O'Keen as well, who's the editor, which was really cool, just to come on and give us a much bigger insight of kind of like Terabytes as well. But also we covered kind of like the history of horror games as well, and their insight and everything on it and their opinion of it and everything. It was really cool. I was like, you know, it's proper like my wheelhouse. Like,
yeah,
you know, I articulate myself with just like, yeah, it's wicked, man, it's wicked. But like, you know,
like, kind if of you want to hear Joe proper nerd out about his favorite genre,
hearing them kind of really dissect and stuff. Yeah, it was awesome. So yeah, if you're into horror games, or even if it's not your thing, and you know, you're just interested in hearing about a history of a genre and stuff like that, really, really, really cool episode.
Looking at the list of stuff that's on here, it's absolutely insane. You know, you've got like so many games we've talked about: Alien Isolation, mm-hmm. The Thing, Night Trap, you know, Silent Hill as well. You've even got, you know, the lead singer of Slipknot on it. It's absolutely bonkers. Like, yeah, huge selection. No wonder you got into it, and I'm sure Dan as well got excited talking about it.
I've got a link that I'll be watching on the plane on the way on holiday next week. So download.
I was actually quite impressed with Dan's knowledge of horror games, actually. Yeah. I was like, yeah.
Full of surprises, aren't I?
Yeah, I was like, check Dan out, to be fair. Like, you know,
I've been paying attention to what you say, Joe. That's all.
You see, I like horror games, it's just movies, so it was fun. The movie's a bit scary.
Yeah.
I love to get involved. Yeah. Good to pause them.
It is an incredible interview as well. And even going back to, you know, stuff like you mentioned then about Night Trap, you know, one of the episodes all about those FMV games. So we talked quite a bit about that, how kind of the industry was viewed at the time. And
Phantasmagoria as well.
Yeah. So there's a lot of chat about that kind of stuff. You love your horror games. Or, I mean, we've had Richard on a few times. He's worked on loads of different things, and he's always such an interesting guy. So he's always welcome back on the podcast. So looking forward to this, talking about horror games with Richard Moss and Connor Keen. There are special guests on the way in around half an hour from now. But of course, first half of the show, that's when we have a chat about what's been happening, the stories that have been landing on our timelines over the last week or so. And you might remember on last week's podcast, we were chatting about the fact that a previously unknown port of Sensible Soccer had been found for the Nintendo Entertainment System, which I thought was pretty cool. And imagine this, just a week later, a long-lost NES port of Populous has been discovered that's been missing for 33 years.
Yeah, this one's really interesting. You know, we covered Sensible Soccer. Sensible Soccer, as we said, was a game that was huge and went onto lots of different systems. Same with Populous. And Populous was, you know, one that really helped kind of establish Bullfrog and Peter Molyneux, but also helped kind of established that whole God game genre. So it's interesting to see it coming on the NES. It was quite a technical achievement when it came out on the Amiga, especially with, you know, the way that you scroll the world. And seeing that on the NES, there's obvious limitations of what you could do compared to the other systems. But what do you think? I think it looks like an all right port. It seems a lot more complete than the Sensible Soccer one we were talking about last week.
Yeah, well, this is actually, it was the same guys who were behind this. It's come out of the same kind of rescue project. This is Mark Greenshield, and he was the guy from Enigma Variations. And this has been uploaded to Frank Gaskin's website, The Games That Weren't. And actually, again, this is another one of those where they've made the ROM available. So if you want to check it out, you can download it. So, again, it's another one of these where, you know, we talked about Sensible Soccer last week. It doesn't look like it got any previews or any mention in magazines at the time. And I imagine it kind of fell victim to the same thing that killed off the Sensible Soccer port, the fact that they were going to release this in 1992 and kind of the NES, you know, particularly over here, was kind of, you know, in its death throes by then. So I imagine that, again, is probably what put an end to this. But it looks very ambitious, I think,
yeah,
because, yeah.
it's such a big game. But also, you know, they've had to rescale everything. Everything's a bit bigger in this, so they can fit, you know, a few items there, but have less kind of people going around in there. That was one of the big things about the Amiga one, was, you know, it's such a huge world as well. The scrolling's a bit flickery, as you go through it. But obviously, these are the limitations. You've got a 16-bit system, and you've got an 8-bit system.
No, it's a 6502 processor, isn't it? And it's doing 3D. Like,
you're reducing it down, you know, massively, and then you're reducing the palette as well. So obviously the people are a bit bigger, a bit fatter, but the concepts are there. I can imagine the gameplay would still be exactly the same. What did you think of Populous? Did you enjoy it when you first played it, Dan?
So I must, again, this is not really my genre, so I've never played Populous before.
People oh my God!
Shocked to hear.
That's one that you're going to have to do on the After Hours podcast, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, yeah, if I'm going to spend a month, because I know how long these games take.
Master Populous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a genre that I'm interested in, that I would like to play. But again, it just looks like, you know, for the limited amount of time I get to game these days, these kind of world-building games, I imagine, could be a rather big time sink. Have you ever played stuff like this, Joe? This is a genre that you've looked at?
Never played Populous.
Yeah. You're on your own, Ravi.
It's interesting, though, because we saw a lot of Bullfrog titles go onto consoles as well. And, you know, like, you had Theme Park. That was a really different game when it came onto consoles as well. And it was all kind of, like, redesigned a bit. Still have kept the essential themes, but we've seen this happen a lot with, like, strategy games and, you know, kind of god games as well. It's always a bit tough with the controllers as well, isn't
it? That was going to be my point. Yeah, playing that with a D-pad, a game that's designed for mouse, how well that
mouse
would work.
And a keyboard as well, actually.
But one good thing as well, if you're a fan of David Whittaker, and there is a previously unheard track of his that is the title music to this game, so that's very cool to see that finally getting out there again. So if you want to check that out, it's looks like it's almost a pretty complete port. Now, last week on that Sensible Soccer one, there's a lot of glitches and bugs in it, but looks like this one got a lot further along.
This, you know, it'll probably have quite a lot more advanced AI in there as well, especially if you're playing versus a computer. You know, Sensible Soccer is pretty basic, but you're controlling a lot more on the screen. With this, it's a bit of a slower pace.
Yeah, so if you want to get hold of that, that is available to download now for your NES. Look forward as well. I mean, it looks like, you know, Mark Greenshields and Darren Melbourne, who is the producer on this game, looks like they're kind of going through their archives at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, if anything else comes out.
Every week we're going to get, this game is developed for the NES, and we'll be like, oh,
yeah,
thank you.
So we'll keep an eye on that. If you want to check it out, I'll put it in this week's show notes. Now, you guys fans of Ghosts and Goblins, I've got a feeling, Joe, didn't you tell me once that you did rather well at that game. Did you complete Ghosts and Goblins once?
I did. I knew you were going to say this. I did.
I think that's the most impressed I've ever been at you, the fact that you did that. I was like, what?
I did the Super Ghouls and Ghosts, or was it Super Ghosts and Goblins? The Super Nintendo version of it, either way. When I was about 17, about 18 years ago, I picked it up for really cheap on Super Nintendo. I bought a Super Nintendo off eBay because I never had one as a kid. It was always like my cousins or my uncle had one. So it was the first thing I ever bought on eBay. Super Nintendo of a bunch of games, and then I went into Playtime in town and bought loads of SNES games because they were still like £3 and GameStation and stuff, and got Super Ghouls and Ghosts, and I knew it was a notoriously hard game. Remember borrowing it or renting it on the Mega Drive version, as a little boy and finding it really tough. But yeah, played it, got good at it over a couple of days. And not only did I beat it, I then did the game where you have to play through the whole game again. You know how...
I hated when games did that. Can you do it again?
Did it the second time. And I've played it a couple of times since. But yeah, I haven't got the patience now, or the skill probably, to do that again. You know, proper kind of like original, no save states, anything like that.
It was a game that used to absolutely batter me when I played it in the arcades. I'd always liked the look of it, and I loved the atmosphere of Ghosts and Goblins and Ghouls and Ghosts. But yeah, they were really difficult games. I could never get very far on them. But now, you know, if you are a fan of that genre, it turns out there is a new Ghosts and Goblins inspired action platformer that is available on Steam already, but also excitingly is coming out on the Neo Geo and the Sega Dreamcast, as well as all of the current consoles. And this is called Gladmort.
Yeah, man, this looks really cool. So Gladmort is a black knight back in the kind of medieval times. And the game is, it's ghosts and goblins. Like, he's going along fighting werewolves and skeletons and zombies with these various weapons that he picks up and collects. Interestingly, it doesn't look like in Ghosts and Goblins where you pick up that one weapon, that's the only weapon you can hold. In this, it looks like there's 6 unlockable weapons that you unlock.
Which might make it a bit easier. Game,
which may make it a little bit easier, but in terms of gameplay, incredibly similar, which isn't a bad thing. It's very, very cool. It's cool to see it coming out, as you say, like on all modern consoles, as well as Steam and then Neo Geo and Dreamcast. In terms of the graphics, it does look to me very Neo Geo, very kind of like extremely good 16-bit graphics. It's very cool. It's only 5 levels, which I'm a little bit like, okay, that might be a bit short, but it is also only £11 on Steam. So I imagine it would be hopefully a similar price on console, because sometimes games, these kind of like indie games, can be like £30, £25.
Yeah.
And you're a little bit like, oh, do I really want to pull the trigger, or should I just wait a year until it's on sale or something? But I think if it's, you know, kind of like £11, £12 on console as well for digital versions, I think that would be quite reasonable, especially if it's as difficult as Ghosts and Goblins, Ghouls and Ghosts, because of, you know, it will have that replayability as well as, you know, it's going to kick your ass.
Yeah. You're going to have level design, to
get further each time.
It really reminds me of Castle Crashers, the level design.
Yeah, and
the huge kind of enemies that you get in there as well. And you know, just that kind of that feel, the way that they've done the pixel art. I don't know why, I just thought Castle Crashers, yeah.
I sort of see that. Yeah, especially with kind of like the setting and stuff. I do love in the trailer, it says prepare to die again and again and again at the end of the trailer. And it's just a montage for the last kind of 10 seconds of him just dying. I'm hoping, and I'm sure it is, it's one of those games where when you die, it's not the game's fault, it's your fault. Like, the controls are, you know, hopefully really tight. And it is just, you know, it's not bad game design or anything like that. It is literally just, you know, it's a difficult game and you just didn't do good enough.
I don't know if I like that idea. At least in the arcades, I could blame like the kid before me for like spilling his cherry coke or something on the joystick and blame that. But
yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, it's going to be all my fault. And this, it was a Kickstarter last year, actually, in the summer. Absolutely smash it. Skull, the one in €35,000, reached almost 200,000. So
it did the 35,000 within the first day.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a market for the genre.
Yeah, so it looks like it's, like I said, already available on Steam. End of the month, probably by the time this podcast comes out, the console version should be available then. Apparently the Dreamcast and Neo Geo versions are shipping physical versions of that this month as well. So, yeah, again, I mean, you know, it's always nice to see new games getting inspired by retro classics. I do notice that his clothes don't fall off and he doesn't strip down to his undies in this one, from what I can see.
Yeah, I think he does lose his armour.
All right, okay.
On the trailer. Have a look.
I'm seeing little Y fronts yet in it, but
I don't think you go down to your Y fronts. No, you do. You do.
All right. Well, there you go. That's it. That's worth buying in just for that.
There you go.
Yeah. Still makes me giggle. So if you want to get hold of that, I'll link up that in this week's show notes as well. Available now to buy. Now, while we're talking about impressive new games, I did mention that last weekend I was on, a couple of weeks ago now, I was on Amiga Bill stream. Talking about, I did the Amiga news section on his great Amiga show that he does on Twitch every Sunday evening. And this is a title that he drew to my attention, which I wasn't familiar with this before. But this is a new, you could call it a hack and slasher that is coming out for the Amiga. And it's had a new teaser. And this is a game called Krogar. Now, graphically, this looks really interesting. There is a video that you can watch, and this is intended to run on pretty much all Amigas, anything with 512k of chip RAM and the extra 512k fast RAM, so, you know, A500, A1000. There is a demo that you can download, which Bill actually did play on his stream, if you want to get a better look at it. But yeah, interestingly, I think it almost looks like the backgrounds are somewhat digitized.
Yeah, it's a kind of look. It's like kind of digitized, but then lower, like level palettes, four colors or something. It's a very Amiga look.
Yeah.
This game does look like it could come out, you know, properly back in the day. And it's called the Berserk. Like Berserker, but Berserker, which I quite like. It's the name. It's interesting, yeah, use of the palette, because it looks a bit washed out, but in a kind of nice way.
Lots of pastel kind of shades and stuff in it.
Yeah, and it's got parallax in there. It doesn't look like the most kind of advanced, amazing, wow, I can't believe this is done on Amiga, but to me, it sits in that kind of time period. It looks fun, the fact that you're going around decapitating people. I think that's very Amiga. You know, heads flying off everywhere. You can decapitate about five people in a row. That's pretty cool. And the sound as well. I was just listening to the soundtrack and they use this boom sample. And you can always hear the kind of fuzz before the sample ends, because I've heard that so many games, you know, and it sounds really good. They've got like stereo separation on there. So this really feels like a kind of snapshot of time on the Amiga that's kind of come back. I really like it. It looks fun. Interesting setting as well. It's only a demo at the moment, isn't it? So I'd love to see what the kind of full game brings. But it does run on like a really low spec Amiga. So you can
everything
from,
really, yeah.
Yeah, you can do it from the Amiga 1000. And I'm liking these developments now that, you know, people are using, instead of the high-end stuff and aiming for the kind of market there, they're going for the really, like, low-spec stuff, which is awesome.
Well, you mentioned that it's called the Berserker, and that is, that's the story of the game, that basically his beer's been stolen from his home village and he's on a mission to get it back.
So, you've got to decapitate some people if you want to get your beer back. Yeah.
I mean, to me, I don't know if you watch a video, Joe, I'm getting big Golden Axe vibes off it.
I didn't get Golden Axe vibes, you know, because it's 2D, kind of like beat 'em up. Not 2D, like just side along. It's not got belt scrolling. You don't move up or down, so it's just one platform. I didn't get the Golden Eye kind of like vibes.
Golden Axe.
Golden Axe vibe. Yeah,
definitely not Golden Eye.
Definitely didn't get Golden Eye vibes from this one, mate. Yeah,
but I think the way the characters like jump and the way the wield the sword and those kind of attacks remind me very much of Golden Axe.
Well, I didn't, you know what? My brain just went to Conan the Barbarian. And like, you know, how Ravi was saying, like the music, it's kind of like Krogar kind of thing. Like, it just reminded me of Conan the Barbarian, where they're going about Crom, which is the god in that.
Yeah. or like Savage was another game that had a soundtrack kind of like that. And it looks a bit like Wrath of the Demon as well, if you ever played that, which was like a side-on one, where you're on a horse. It was pretty fun.
It reminds me, I'll tell you what it reminds me of a little bit, Shadow of the Beast.
Graphically, a little bit.
I agree. And obviously, that was like a massive game on the Amiga, so I think there is definitely some inspiration there. The only thing I'm thinking is, you know, again, like I remember, you know, talking about Golden Axe, my favorite memories of that are always sitting on the couch playing that with my brother, being another character. Would be great if they could have two-player co-op on this.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's two-player, does it?
No, just an idea, you know. I think that those games are always a lot more fun. But apparently I imagine they're not going to do it before release, because it's meant to be out by the end of this month. But it would be awesome to see that in a future version. And if you want to get the demo of it, that is available to play now. As you said, Ravi plays on pretty much all Amigas, including the A500 Mini, obviously. So I'll link up their itch page in the show notes this week. Now, this is a story that I think it's worth covering, because it's always nice to have this front of mind. And obviously, if it does save someone's house, their collection, or even your life, actually, it's always worth thinking about these things and just checking your kit every now and then, because I imagine a lot of us have got a load of handhelds and stuff buried away in cupboards that we don't really check on all that much. It's something I thought about, actually, was I started buying a load of old iPods years ago, and some of them are kind of buried deep in the recesses of my cupboard, and I probably haven't seen them for 5 years. And there was one of them definitely last time I saw it. The screen had a little dark patch on it.
Was it a Nano?
Yeah, it might have been, actually. I think it was a classic, actually, Ravi. One of the Apple classics.
Okay, because, they basically sponge up, don't they? Well, they get
Spicy
bigger.
Pillows, it's called.
Spicy pillow. That's what I was looking for, yeah. And the batteries kind of expand inside, especially like older batteries. That can be dangerous if you do plug them in and stuff. I don't think we're going to have I'm no expert on this, but I don't think we're going to have old batteries exploding. I guess they tend to leak everywhere, which is a big problem. You know, if you've got an old Game Boy or something and there's a pair of cheap AA batteries in there and then they've leaked all over and ruined things. Of course, we know a lot about leaking batteries with the Amiga Varta batteries as well, which have caused no end of trouble and destruction with Amigas. But this story is interesting because it's a PSP battery that was actually plugged in. The guy came back to it and it had exploded. I can imagine with it expanding and everything and then plugging it in, maybe
it happened while he was asleep.
Yeah, yeah. So he kind of left it on and then, boom.
Yeah, he says he heard it explode in his sleep, like he heard a bang and he thought he was dreaming. And he went over to it and the battery had burst out of it and landed on his futon, which it had burnt through.
Wow.
And then he tried to touch it and it burnt all his fingertips, which is scary. But he does confirm that it is a secondhand PSP and he's not sure whether it's an original battery or a replacement battery. But then apparently this has been an issue with PSPs, with the actual Sony battery swelling up, like you say, spicy pillows, for a good couple of years now. I don't have a PSP, so I can't check. I've never even owned one or anything.
I do have one, actually, in this drawer next to me.
Have a look, quick.
I remember people used to replace the batteries and put these extended ones in. And bigger life batteries, and a lot of them were third market.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of buy off the internet.
And mine looks okay, luckily.
Does it look all right, does it?
Yeah. It has been a thing, you're right. And again, with old iPods, it's a thing that often the gases in these batteries make them expand. Mm-hmm. I remember I had it when, it must have been about mid-20s. I remember I had a receipt scanner. And I'd never seen that. The bottom of it just kind of popped off and I saw the battery expanded in there. I hadn't really heard about this at that point. And I remember thinking, that's really weird. I remember thinking at the time, should I burst it? Glad I didn't, because that can cause very hazardous, not only breathing in the gases, but also can start a fire as well. But I've seen videos of people, even with modern laptops. There's a video doing the rounds a couple of years ago of some guy in his office. He left his MacBook plugged in permanently. He went home one night and security cameras caught it. The battery in that ignited, burnt down the entire office. So I think ever since I saw that, I've always been very cautious about leaving things on charge unattended.
Mm. Yeah,
100%. Well, also some of the chargers, there's some horror stories of people picking up, cheap chargers and stuff and chargers with problems and those blowing up as well. So, be really careful. Even e-cigarettes and all those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, Mark fixes battery, things really. Yeah. We've had on the show.
Yeah.
His house burnt down from a third party plug. Well, he believes. Yeah. Which is terrible. So yeah, you got to be careful with these things.
Especially with the older systems as well. I mean, I've replaced a few iPod batteries with ones I bought off eBay. They claim to be official, but again, you don't know.
Mm.
So, some of them are not made to EU safety standards. So, just definitely worth checking your old systems anyway, I think, And if you have got any expanded batteries, getting rid of those and replacing them with hopefully official ones. Even, the other day I opened up my Philips CDI remote control that had batteries in there from years ago. And there were actually those, it was quite funny because do you remember when Duracell batteries had those little battery meters on where you put your finger and your thumb on?
Yeah, I love those. But you could actually, you had to squeeze it tight and check and you'd have a little measure.
They hurt your fingers though, didn't they? I remember pressing really hard on them. I found one of those in it though. So that proves that I haven't changed the batteries in that for many years. So just a little reminder that maybe this weekend, have a little look at your collection and check on those batteries.
Buy my batteries from an old military shop. when it would just be like all these Chinese batteries in a huge like barrel, and the bloke would be like, right, here's a tester. And then it'd be like, you know, for a tenner you can get 20. And you just go in there and you sit there testing all these like really sketchy batteries, and then just get them, take them home, because they were quite expensive back there.
Ravi with his military grade batteries.
Yeah.
So yeah, just a reminder though, yeah, check your batteries. Always a good practice, I think. Right, then we are going to be chatting to this week's special guest, Horror Games special coming up. Richard Moss and Connor O'Keen talking about their amazing new documentary. And of course, just general horror game nostalgia with the guys from Terabytes are on the way in just a minute. A little reminder that we do have a patron that hugely supports this podcast. We did our patrons hangout last weekend. And this is something we do at the end of every month. I mean, people might have heard us talking about the hangout. I think, what on earth is a hangout all about? Remind us, Joe, what can people expect from a Retro Hour hangout?
A lot of everything, to be honest. It always starts off talking about, sometimes we talk about what we've covered in the show, you know, any sort of new gadgets or anything like that, or retro gadgets. And then it always moves on to kind of like what people have bought recently. It's just like hanging out with mates. And I've said it, I sound like a broken record. I've genuinely made really good friends from, you know, the Patreon hangout. You know, people I consider my friends. We've met so many people in person now from around the world, which is just absolutely mind-blowing. But yeah, we jump on and we just chat like about tech, about horror films, about just films in general, stuff that's been on TV recently. You know, there's always some sort of kind of connection to, like, you know, what we all... the Retro Hour, in terms of like what the Retro Hour is, in terms of what we cover and stuff like that. But it isn't just video games or anything like that. And, you know, some people have a drink, some people even spend some money, i.e. me, buying stuff that we've been every time. Guaranteed.
They also, you know, talk about projects that people have been doing, repairs, like
advice as well, which is great.
And, you know, stuff that they've got going. And then that also adds to a lot more questions, because people like go, oh, how you got that going? What have you done there? You know, it's a really interesting conversation.
And we'd like to welcome new people every time as well. You know, we always see new faces coming in. Always very welcoming bunch as well. So if you want to join a wonderful patrons community, you also get an extra 10, 15 minutes of news stories on every episode, because we chop the ads out for you. And you also get a bonus podcast if you're a gold member above. A new episode just dropped last week called The Retro Hour After Hours. So if you'd like to support the podcast, that's what it's all about, really. Make sure that we can make it up to that 500th episode and beyond. All the details to join our community are at theretrohour.com. All right, then, now before we hop into this week's special guest, just a quick moment to give a huge thank you to this week's sponsor. It is our incredible friends at Shopify. You know them? That's the sound of making a sale on Shopify. Love it when you hear that. It means someone has just bought one of your products. Maybe you've got a little side hustle going on right now. Maybe 2025 is a year that you're starting your own business. And obviously we're getting into the time of year now when all the retro gaming trade shows and events and gaming markets are coming up as well. You often see people that have these little Shopify point of sale systems, because it means that you can take card payments in person. And also it links back to your Shopify inventory as well. So it keeps it all together, because Shopify is the all-in-one e-commerce platform designed to start, run, and grow your business. So whatever you sell, we've been selling our books on there for over a year now. The thing about it is, though, because we did a Kickstarter initially for our books, that was quite complex to set up, I remember, and even manually having to do all the shipping labels and working out postage. You set our Shopify page up, Ravi. It just takes care of all of that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's like a drag and drop design, and you also have pre-made designs on there. It's really easy to do, but also, you know, digital delivery is fantastic on there as well. So, you know, you can choose the amount of people that are, amount of times people are able to download it. If you want to have any DRM, you know, all of that kind of stuff, watermarking. It's really interesting, and it kind of, you know, takes all the hassle out of it.
Yeah, 100%. You can just focus on the thing you enjoy doing most, running your business, and let Shopify take care of all the other stuff for you. And like you said, you don't need any skills in design or coding. It does it all for you. So if you sell anything at all, in person or online, it's time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Now, you know that we've got an amazing offer. If you want to try Shopify, do it using our link, and you can try it out for just £1 a month. for a trial period. So head to shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase. I'll put it in the show notes so you can click straight through. shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. All right, well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you, of course, on next Friday's podcast. A little reminder that we do have a section in our Discord server. And if you're not on our Discord, why not? It is free for everyone to join. We have a link on our website, theretrohour.com. And if you spot any news stories, always appreciate you dropping them in there. And hopefully we'll feature that on a future episode. Right, then next, going to be chatting to this week's special guests, a real special on horror games with Richard Moss and Connor O'Keen. They're on the way next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guests. Now, you may recall an episode that we did a couple of years ago now, actually, talking about this incredible new documentary series all about the history of horror video games called Terabytes. And there's been quite a lot of progress made on that over the last 18 months or so since we last mentioned it, including, and I know, Joe, you've actually seen a couple of episodes about it that I'm sure we spoke about in the news section of the podcast before this. But we thought to have a bit of a catch-up about kind of the current state of the documentary series. And also, obviously, you know that our Joe is a massive horror game fan, so thought we'd get on a couple of that like-minded people. Let's first of all welcome a good friend of the show who's been on several times now and is always so much fun to talk to, Richard Moss. How you doing, Richard?
I'm great. It's a pleasure to be here again. Always love hanging out with you guys.
Yeah, it's always so much fun. And I know you guys are based down under, so we appreciate the time difference and you organising your day around it. So that's really appreciated. And you're actually one of the writers and directors on Terabytes. And also we have Connor as well, who is the editor of Terabytes. So welcome, Connor.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, really appreciate you taking some time. Now, obviously, we're going to be talking lots about horror games in general, but I know, Richard, you've worked on some incredible things over the last few years, including lots of books that we've talked about, other series as well. We're going to talk a bit more about kind of your work on Terabytes, but I thought with you, Connor, you know, being a first timer on the Retro Hour podcast as well, I mean, what's kind of your kind of background in gaming then? I mean, have you always been a horror game fan? What's kind of your history there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I said during the like interview kind of process for getting this gig with Richard and Daniel on Terabytes that since about the age of 14, it's been heavy metal, horror, and video games. And it's not so much a Venn diagram as it is a circle. It's a big old greasy pizza. And horror games is a huge part of that. But ever the anxious kid, I watched more horror video games than I played, at least up until I played Resident Evil 4 for the first time and went like, oh my God, this is a thrill. And since then, it's been fairly constant, especially in recent years when I've had less time to devote to video games as a pastime. I will make the time for horror titles, especially in the indie space.
So you mentioned there Resident Evil 4. Kind of like a lot of people's wheelhouse, Resident Evil as a series in general, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. But one question we like to ask all of our guests is, what was your first ever gaming memory? Like, cast your mind back.
My very first video game memory would be playing Crash Bandicoot 2. But in terms of like first video game memories where it kind of frightened me to a serious degree was playing Max Payne for the first time when I was about 12 or 13. And I just thought, yeah, cool, like diving through the air, you know, guns. I just discovered who John Woo was from watching Face Off. And I was like, I'm in Face Off, dude. This is amazing. And then it gets to the nightmare sequence where the baby's crying. There's blood on the floor. There's a trail. You can hear the wife who's, you know, dead at this point saying, like screaming Max's name. And it's horrible and it's horrifying. And it affected me so deeply that I felt the need to like confess to my dad that I'd played this game that really frightened me. And then, you know, years later now, like cut to now, you guys have seen it. There's a portion of this Terabytes doco that talks about that part in Max Payne. And I felt utterly vindicated, you know, more than half my lifetime later. I was like, yes,
fantastic.
I'm not a wuss.
That is incredible. I mean, obviously, Richard, we've had you on before talking about different genres. I mean, in terms of horror games for you, I mean, what are your kind of earliest memories of games that frightened you?
That Max Payne moment is one of the most memorable bits for me, but that happened, like, that's later. I'm a teenager at that point. I think before that, the classic Tomb Raider games had a big mark on me. They're among my favorites. You guys can see I've got some boxes on the shelves behind me. Tomb Raider 1 and 2 have heaps of horror elements in them. They're really frightening. There's a level in Tomb Raider 2 that I like to talk about, 40 Fathoms, where you're under the sea, you start out, it's dark, you don't know where you are, where you're going, and you're going to run out of oxygen, you're going to die if you don't get to somewhere that has a pocket of air. But then you find out there's also two sharks chasing after you. And what do? And it's terrifying as you're swimming through the darkness trying to find them and the sharks are chomping at you. Before that, I don't know, it's a bit hazier. What might have scared me before that, I had little bits and pieces of experiences with games like Doom and Alone in the Dark. There's some things that are horror and horror adjacent, but I guess Marathon, actually, come to think of it, would have been
on the Mac.
One of the first. I was too young probably to play that when I first came across it, and I didn't actually get to play it. I was watching my brother playing, and it's a scary bloody game. For people who don't know, there's a lot of dark corridors, kind of mazy. It uses light, similar to how Doom uses light and dark a lot. But then there's also these monsters called the aliens called the Sfit. They're like guys in red cloaks, and they open up the cloak and a green fireball thing comes out at you, and they move silently and just appear out of nowhere in the darkness. And it's terrifying the first time you encounter one of those in the first level of the game.
Playing that with the lights turned off in your room at night, yeah.
Isn't it interesting there that you mentioned Tomb Raider? That, you know, there's these games that aren't inherently horror games or even maybe meant to be scary. But it's funny because I was racking my brain, you know, and I'm not the one being interviewed here, so I need to make sure I don't take over just because of my love of horror games. But you mentioned Tomb Raider, and I remember Tomb Raider 2, that first level, was it Great Wall of China, where the tigers come out? And I remember, you know, turn it off, like, because it was scary, because you're getting chased. Like, and for somebody who's, you know, I was preteen at that point, but it's like, I remember playing with my next door neighbor and being that scared, turn it off. And it didn't come to my mind as like, oh yeah, that was probably the first game that scared me until you said it. But it's really interesting that you have these games which aren't necessarily horror games, but can fall into the genre in some part. I think that's really cool.
And actually, it was a big part of what we were trying to do with Terabytes. Dan Richardson, the producer on this, he brought the idea of the Terabytes to us. And you had Dan on whenever it was that you last talked about Terabytes. He and I talked a lot about what we're going to do with this documentary. And it came up with both of us that we wanted to explore what horror even is in games. I've never been a really big horror guy. I've always kind of dabbled rather than being crazy about it. Like him, he's obsessed with horror. So I've had to reevaluate a lot of things as I've been doing research on this. And I was realizing that, oh, actually a lot of the games that I love have horror elements in them, or they're horror adjacent. Like Tomb Raider has a lot of horror in it, even though nobody really calls it a horror game. So we wanted to put that throughout the whole series, that there's horror in anything. Horror can just sneak up on you, and that's actually when it's often the most effective, when it takes you by surprise because of what it is. Horror is like, it's an emotion, it's a vibe. It can be very, very effective when you're not expecting it rather than when you're just soaking in it, like in a survival horror game.
Where would you say the kind of history of horror games started then? Because I mean, I'm looking at the games you cover in episode one. You've even got stuff like 3D Monster Maze in there, which is shown briefly. And that's again, I mean, you know, maybe a game that I suppose it is kind of, you know, the roots of survival horror, I guess. I mean,
it's impossible when you're trying to figure out like what's first. And we've even got this in the first episode. We've got Bernard Perron, who's an academic who studies scary games, talking about how we're always trying to figure out what's first, and he gives these examples, and he's like going back in time, and he's like, well, it's pointless having this discussion because the term survival horror, for instance, didn't exist until 1996 when you had Resident Evil. But there's all these games that have Resident Evil type ideas in them that go back way further than that. And because horror is something that is more a feeling than a like a defined set of tropes or mechanics, it's open, very much open to interpretation where it starts. So if you wanted to go back to like the 1970s on mainframes and on Plato, you can probably find some things that a lot of people found scary. I'm sure a lot of people got afraid when they're playing Zork on a mainframe, or like Hunt the Wumpus, or Colossal Cave even. These things can scare you. There's frightening elements in them. As for like things that are more overtly scary, it probably sort of starts more in the 1980s. I think Sinistar, we talked about that in the first episode, is actually one of the first really scary games. And that's because the bad guy in that is just terrifying as he hunts you and chases you down with that horrifying scream. You know, the I live and I hunger.
I was going to mention Sinistar. I've never actually played Sinistar, but seen...
Too scared.
No, I'd never heard of it, and I've seen the YouTube videos of it. And I can't remember who it was, but the YouTube videos of it. And I remember just lying in bed watching it. I was unsettled as an adult, like, ooh. Like, but once again, it's a space game. It's a, you know, asteroids or whatever kind of thing. It's not a horror game, but the elements are there. The terror is 100% there. And yeah, it's just whether that was the intention of the game developers, or if it's just, you know, poor sampling, like a bit crushing in the 80s. Yeah.
From what I can gather, we were going to interview Noah Falstein, but he pulled out, sadly. But from what I can gather from research over the years is that they didn't really mean to make a scary game. What they were trying to do was make a difficult game. Like, it's an arcade game, so they want to make it, they want to have a lot of friction. They want to make it hard. And they want to have this unkillable foe so that you are just like always going back and trying again and again and again. And you've got to get so good at that game to be able to beat Sinistar. It's almost impossible. It's like infamous for how hard it is.
Yeah.
And absolutely. It just so happens that they had the technology to do voice samples. And that's really what makes the game scary. It's this guy with a digitized voice screaming at you, run!
And I think the low bit rate and the quality of it probably makes it scarier because it sounds quite otherworldly.
That lo-fi element is something that really helps horror. And we talk about that in episode 4. We got a segment talking about chunky pixels, like how when you lower the fidelity, you actually can make things more frightening because you can't tell exactly what's going on. It's got that muddiness, that murkiness. And if you aren't sure what something is, even like Silent Hill, you could think about it. It's famous for the fog. You don't know what's going to come out of the fog. Tomb Raider has fog too. Like it's something that can be quite effective. That mystery, that unknown, and that that roughness creates a lot of tension.
I think part of what made Sinistar so scary was too also the fact that it was an arcade game and there was real money at stake for these kids playing it. I think that sense of death having real consequence kind of creates a greater sense of fear as well, and that being a big part of like Sweet Home being, you know, a pretty serious precursor to Resident Evil and stuff. That being a big part of that game and what made that game scary and effective was that if you lost a party member, that was it, they were gone. And yeah, it felt like death had real consequence and it was really something to avoid. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting seeing those early games use limitations as, you know, the mother of invention in the name of scaring the Jesus out of people. And I think I mentioned indie games earlier. I love that that's becoming something that people are going back to with indie titles, kind of leaning into the low poly look and that aesthetic and those restrictions as a way to create something really scary. Stuff like Lost in Vivo or Faith being a huge example of that. It's an exciting time for it to see all that stuff coming back.
We've been talking about it on the podcast pretty much every week. There's some new like PS1 style survival horror game. A lot of them heavily influenced by obviously the early Resident Evil games. But I mean, why do you think that aesthetic has come back into fashion recently? Is it just we're getting to an age now where that was far enough?
Yeah, I think it's just the nostalgia kind of loop, the 30-year cycle or thereabouts kind of it's kicking in for that kind of horror and that kind of graphical style. And I think it's people who are old enough to have a skill set that they want to dedicate to making, you know, video games and stuff on a low budget, being fascinated with that stuff, either because they grew up with it at the tail end of, you know, that being in vogue, or it's not something they grew up with and they're just utterly fascinated by it. Yeah, I think it's a mix of those things.
Yeah, 100% agree. I think as well, the 32-bit era, you know, we entered the 3D realm by this, you know, by that point. I think it was kind of like when you could stop using your imagination, stuff was truly unsettling. I remember Silent Hill playing the demo and that, you know, when you first go into that alleyway and you see that, you know, things strung up and stuff, you know, the gore, you know, I'd already played kind of like Sega Mega Drive games and Super Nintendo games that have horror elements to them. But you know, a skeleton in Golden Axe isn't that scary. Whereas all of a sudden when you're seeing somebody strung up with their insides all hanging out, it's truly unsettling all of a sudden, and you don't have to use your imagination. And I wonder if, you know, these indie devs, they kind of capture that essence by kind of, you know, mimicking those 32-bit era graphics as well.
There's sort of like this Goldilocks zone where if you don't have enough fidelity, it's just a blob. Like you go to Atari 2600 days, the dragon looks like a duck. And that's the fidelity they had back then. You go to like the latest AAA games, they're so hyper real. There's nothing left to your imagination anymore. It's still easy to like shock you because something's so disgusting. But is it scaring you because of it's frightening, or is it scaring you just because it's disgusting? And
yeah,
it's just that visceral response of, oh, that's really yucky, I don't want to look at it. And there's this zone kind of in between that particularly happened in that 32-bit era where things looked just good enough that you could tell what was going on, but your imagination still had to fill in the blanks on the detail. And that's where things can be really, really, really scary.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I think people like Airdorf get really creative with it, with the like rotoscoped cutscenes as well, because without those cutscenes, the game would still be unsettling. It would still be kind of strange, but it wouldn't have this kind of cursed quality that it does have that really makes people stand up and look and go, what the, you know.
I think as well, the early 3D games, like you talk about Alone in the Dark in episode one. And I think looking back at those kind of low fidelity polygons, even at the time, I remember that game coming out and being really impressed and thought it looked amazing. Obviously, it looks very clunky now. But again, I think, you know, in terms of horror games kind of pushing the boundaries of technology as well, I imagine that the start of the 3D era really gave horror game developers literally a whole new dimension.
Yeah, it's harder, I think, it's harder to find examples of people making things convincingly frightening back in the 2D era. You know, a lot of people have done it now in the indie scene, but that's sort of borrowing ideas from 3D and like, how can I translate this down to 2D and then how can I be creative with the design? But if you go back to the 8-bit and the 16-bit console eras, it's maybe it's also partly that games were marketed mainly to kids back in those days, but there aren't a lot of examples other than like Clock Tower of things that were effective in being frightening. That we've got a lot of stuff in episode two that you guys would have seen of games that were just not at all frightening, but they're based on some of the most terrifying horror movies of all time. It's this really weird disconnect.
It's funny you should mention that, because obviously we've spoke about kind of like hardware limitations and stuff like that. And one of the questions, before we get a little bit more into how you guys got involved with Terabytes, one of the questions I was going to ask was about limitations, etc. But in terms of like creative design, like Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, classically these enemies, there's one enemy, you know, you find in a lot of these games, you're fighting bats with stones and rats and stuff like that. Do you think that is just down to hardware limitations, or do you think it's down to licensing limitations? You know, do you think these games were particularly scary at the time? I know they're probably all a little bit before our time, but, you know, you've done a lot of research on this, Richard. Were they seen as scary games, or were they just seen as funny little kind of like side-alongs to the franchise?
For the most part, no, they weren't seen as particularly scary. There'd be little moments that might scare people, like I think it's Friday the 13th has the Freddy's coming bit, and it's like a Nightmare on Elm Street. Is it catches you by surprise, and because it's a four-player game, it creates this this really great tension. It's more frightening for the urgency of the moment than for actually being a scary moment.
The Friday the 13th, I think, for the Commodore 64, if I'm not mistaken, has those like moments where it's got like a sprite with a machete in somebody's head, and it really is grotesque, and it's accompanied with this like bit crushed like scream, and like that's scary, but kind of in like an abrasive, like, oh, what are you doing? Like, stop that kind of way.
Yeah, it's like a jump scare, but it's because the sound is so frightening.
Exactly. And actually, Shadowgate,
getting out of license games, Shadowgate did that too on the 16-bit computer on Amiga and Mac. I've never played the Nintendo port. I assume that had it too. When you die in Shadowgate, you get the skull come up, plays a frightening sound, and the whole game is like silent the rest of the time.
I think beyond that, most of those games, especially the licensed tie-in ones, were considered a bit naff even at the time, and certainly not particularly scary. But I think that's a mix of limitations for the time, meaning creating something genuinely atmospheric and frightening was hard, you know, probably damn near impossible. And not like licensing limitations, but licensing pressures. You know, these games were pumped out to make a buck, you know, to tie in with a movie that had just come out, or, you know, it was merchandise. It wasn't a piece of art, you know. I think there are horror movies that came out in the 80s and 90s that got video game adaptations that were so terrible that I think if given the right treatment today, could be genuinely, you know, brilliant. I don't mean to keep harping on about Airdorf, but can you imagine like a Long Legs game in the style of Faith, or like The Exorcist 3 in the style of Faith? Like, you know, that stuff makes me excited, but unfortunately it's not the reality for the time.
I think as well, you're right, because I imagine a lot of the movie companies, they, you know, got someone like Ocean Software approaching them. Can we make a game of, you know, your franchise? And like, they probably didn't even really understand what video games were, or the audience was.
No.
There's even a bit in episode 2 about how a lot of people, license holders, they just don't understand games. That's one of the classic things you get when you work on licensed games of all types. It's people, they don't get it. They want you to make the movie, but it's a game. Or they want to control everything. They've got some vision of their own, and they're like, you're going to make this, and they don't understand how interactivity works. Or they just keep interfering. It happens a lot.
Terabytes. Obviously, I've watched a couple of episodes now. Absolutely loving it. Really excited to see the next 3 episodes. Obviously, Richard, you're writing, directing, and Connor, you're editing the documentary as well. How did you both get involved? Mm-hmm. What's the story there? How did it all start, and how did you guys get approached, etc.?
We were being the team that I was in at the time, making first person shooter documentary. I think I talked to you guys with David. David Craddock a few years ago when we were finishing that. So we were wrapping that up, and we got a pitch sent in from this guy, Daniel Richardson. He's a huge horror buff. He's also a YouTube video essayist and works various other jobs. He knew our executive producer, Robin Block, and he like loves the In Search of Darkness series, which is the company's more famous franchise. And he thought we could do something with horror games. And he went back and forth a bit. I got pulled into this conversation pretty early on because Robin wanted to find a new project for me to jump into. And we pretty quickly decided it should be an episodic series on horror games. And then he had like 12 or so ideas, might have even been a little more, for different episodes we could do. We gradually, with a bit of back and forth, narrowed that down to 5. Obviously, survival horror was always going to be in it, but then it's like, what else are we going to run with? And then that went to a validation, which means that we wanted to check that there's actually interest in this. So Dan was basically leading things, doing most of the work himself at this point. It's his idea. We just said, okay, you want to make this, we'll do it if you can prove that there's an audience for it. So he went everywhere talking about it, selling people on it. We got lots of survey answers, people saying, yeah, they're interested, and giving us thoughts on what they would like a horror gaming documentary to delve into, themes, games, people to talk to, all of that. And then about a year ago, we did an initial pre-sales campaign. I guess you could think of it as a crowdfund. It loosely defined our budget for production without giving us hard limits, because we could go over, the company could pay extra if we happened to go a little bit over budget, if we had to. It just means we get less money at the end. And so for the past year, we've been working hard. If we've interviewed 51 people, I think it is, for this thing. And around, what was it, June or so last year, I think, we got Connor in. We needed an editor. We needed somebody to edit the thing, because Dan just didn't have the bandwidth to do it, and he's not really experienced enough as an editor to do the editing side. And I know podcast editing, but I can't really, I can't do it either. So yeah, we advertised, and we happened to get a random email from Connor, who had applied for an In Search of Darkness editing gig a while back. And Connor told the story there.
Yeah, what kind of drew you to it, Connor?
Like Richard mentioned, I'd previously had the opportunity to do a bit of an audition edit for Creative VC for In Search of Darkness, and was working with footage of their the interview footage that they had for their first doco, the first one, The Thing segment. And I worked on that, submitted that, got through to like the last kind of round, and unfortunately didn't get the gig. But got a really lovely email thanking me for my time and saying, you know, do keep in touch though, you know, and just because, you know, you take that as like, oh, they just say that, they don't mean it. So I never got back in touch. And about a year and a bit goes by, and I'm looking for work as an editor. The place that I had been freelancing at, the work just dried up. And I'm looking at all these ads for, you know, video editor roles in Melbourne, and damn near all of them say, like, you know, we want someone who lives and breathes social media. And I'm like, gag, dude. Like, if I ever wake up living and breathing social media, take me out behind a shed. And I was talking to my partner at the time, and I was having a bit of a bitch, pardon my French. And she said, oh, well, what would be like your dream job? And I said, the closest thing I ever got to a dream job was this audition edit. She said, oh, what did they say? And I said, oh, they said to keep in touch. And she's like, well, did you? And I was like, no. She's like, you should get in touch. So I did. I shot them an email. And it just so happened they just started looking for an editor. And Robin got back to me and said, hey, like, you know, appreciate your enthusiasm. Do you have, I'd sent a show reel. It was like, do you have any examples of your work in the documentary kind of sphere? And I had a project from the previous year that was kind of, it was a promo for a university, but it was in like a documentary format, quite short. And then I had an 80-minute documentary that I put together by myself on my own band as like a DVD nice. Extra for our first album. And I submitted that thinking, all right, this is a Hail Mary, but let's see how it goes. And it got me an interview. So, yay. And straight away, I mean, like meeting Daniel and Richard and Robin, even virtually, I was like, I love this team. I love this project. I want to be involved in it. You know, he's hoping, and, I got the gig, and it's been a dream job. Honestly, it's been, the biggest thing I've ever worked on, at this stage, and, the most fulfilling as well. It's been excellent.
Well, like we said at the start, we did have Dan, the producer of Terabytes, on the podcast. I think it was about last July. So when things were just kind of getting off the ground, I mean, just a bit of a recap though, Richard. I mean, you know, for people that are not familiar with it, I mean, it charts the rise of horror in video games. Tell us a bit more about it then. So I know it is split over five different episodes. What's kind of the aim of it then, and what can people expect from it?
I guess at a top level, you can get the gist of what we're doing from the title, which is Terabytes, the evolution of horror gaming. So we're delving into how horror games have evolved over time, which means, of course, there's a big historical element. We're trying to get back, not necessarily to the very root of everything, but we're going way back and looking at how things were in the early days, and then taking a journey up to the present for each themed episode. So the first episode's about survival horror primarily. We also delve a bit into this idea of what even is horror in that first episode, which is a theme that I tried to write through the whole series that we just keep coming back to. So in every episode, there's something that challenges the notions of what horror even means. Second episode, we're about licensed games and homages. Obviously you get movie licenses, but then there's also an I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream segment, adapted, again, brilliant adventure game adapted from the Harlan Ellison short story of the same name. And we've also got Deadly Premonition in there, which is pretty much a Twin Peaks game, but it was never officially licensed as Twin Peaks. Third episode, we're delving into full motion video games like Night Trap, Phantasmagoria, Gabriel Knight games had a bit of FMV in there. So we did a segment on that as well. For the you know, that evolution arc, we were thinking about how, well, nowadays FMV games basically live on in things like Until Dawn, but also games that are a bit more in that horror adjacent kind of vein, like Her Story and Immortality from Sam Barlow's Half Mermaid Company. Really, really interesting games that are very unsettling, even if they're not like obliquely horror. It's not coursing through their veins that this is scary, but they're very unsettling. Then episode four is The Rise of the Indies. I'm a historian. I can tell you indies have always been around. They never went away. They were always there. You go back to the beginning of the 1980s. The first games companies, they were indie. The Bedroom Coder era, that's indie. The Shareware era in the 90s, that's indie. So indie was always there. But for the episode, we're focusing on the indie scene, which is like the past 15 years or so. You go back to things like Minecraft, in the horror space, Amnesia, World of Goo, another non-horror game, like that kind of era, up to the present day. So exploring that scene and how it's kind of become the creative center of what horror is in the game space. And the final episode is called Cursed and Controversial. And on the controversial side is basically about video game violence and sex and how it intersects with horror gaming. So you've got Night Trap controversy, the most ridiculous, overblown thing. It's such a campy game, and yet people were trying to get it banned for its extreme sexual violence.
It's no worse than any of the teen slasher movie of the early 90s, is it?
It's much tamer than any of that stuff, even. It's like Scooby-Doo. Like, you know. It's really tame. But then at the other end,
Do you think it's just because it was on a video game system and maybe parents assumed, you know, video games are aimed at kids? Do you think that's why we had that controversy with Night Trap?
Some US senators had a bone to pick with games for whatever reason. And They chose Mortal Kombat, which makes sense. The fatalities were pretty intense. And then Night Trap, it seems to have just been because it's real people. Like it's the most realistic graphics that you could possibly get, because it's just filmed footage of real people. And they found that quite confronting, and they thought that video games were only for kids. And they're talking like 10-year-old kids, and they're imagining these kids playing this game, and they're reading a description of the game and the things that happen in it, or they're seeing a little bit of footage out of context, and that they think that's really intense. This young woman is getting dragged away by men in black hoods, and they've got some weird device up to her neck that's draining her blood. That if you don't have any understanding of video games, can sound like it's pretty serious. It's pretty intense. And
yeah. And if your only exposure to that kind of imagery was coming from, like, the Video Nasties era and stuff like that in terms of films, you know, Slumber Party Massacre, this ain't. But, like, at a glance, if you were to just put the two side by side and show them to somebody who's not familiar, not au fait with any of that stuff, they're going to assume, you know, the worst of they're going to see Slumber Party Massacre and go, oh, my God, it's that, but you play it? You do the thing?
Yeah.
Obviously, five incredible episodes planned there, and you know, I think they're the perfect kind of genres, what's the word I'm looking for, themes that you've gone for. But how did you pick the subjects? You know, did Dan Richardson come up with them, or was there kind of like a round table discussion to say this is the narrative that we want to go for with this series?
At the level of the themes, it was all Dan. Cool. Like I had said earlier, he had about a dozen different ideas for things. I can see if I can find it here, but he has a spreadsheet that he created with a list of all the different ideas he had. So, like, besides these ones I've talked about, I remember there's one about, like, monsters, like vampires and werewolves and things like that, which would be really cool if we can do a season two. I'd love to delve into that.
Nightmare creatures, et cetera.
And so we being like me, Robin and Dan, kind of hashed it out. We talked a bit. Robin kept handing documents to me on Slack and being like, what do you think of this? And I'd give some feedback, and we went with what we thought was the most compelling, the most interesting ideas. So like FMV, it's, really, an unsung era. There's a lot of creativity and passion that went into that era, but people just laugh about them now. Like Night Trap is constantly joked about. The Seventh Guest is joked about. But the people who made it were really talented people who are making something that it might not be art, but it's got a lot of artistic elements to it. And we thought that it deserves a reappraisal. There's something special about this, and that played out as we dug into it and we did the interviews. And the interview with Graham Devine about the Seventh Guest was beautiful. I wish I could show you guys that. But he cried because it means so much to him, this game, this thing that he worked on. He cried when he heard the theme music for the first time. He put blood, sweat, and tears into this. So much love and passion went into all these games. Phantasmagoria as well was like Roberta Williams' magnum opus. People make fun of it now in some circles, but she was really trying to push the limits of what games could do. She was really exploring this idea of, can a video game scare you? And all of these FMV games were people who thought that the future of interactivity was a blending of film and games. And it turns out that they were right, but they were way too early. The technology wasn't ready yet. But how cool that they went for it, I think. And I think it was the first episode that I really gravitated towards, this idea of celebrating the ideas that they had. And reappraising the games that they made. And indies was totally natural because it's like, if you think about horror games today, your mind's probably going to things like Iron Lung and Faith and Slay the Princess. Like, these are indie games, or the Amnesia series is kind of what some people call like AA indie and stuff, but it was self-published by Frictional all the way through. They've been self-publishing. They're effectively indie. And the Outlast series, another thing, even Dead by Daylight, which we put in a different episode, they've self-published for part of that era, and there's an indie component to it. So it's companies publishing their own games and having that creative freedom to do their own thing is what's driving horror forward at the moment. So that was total no-brainer. Survival horror is a no-brainer because it's what people think of when they think of the horror genre. Mm. And Cursed and Controversial seemed like a really cool idea.
I'm interested as well. I mean, you mentioned then, Richard, about, you know, Seventh Guest. And, you know, if I think of that game, it's that iconic scene when the camera goes up the stairway and you get the ghost at the top, which, you know, burned into my brain when I saw that for the first time. Just jaw-dropping graphics for the time, with seeing full motion video on a PC. I mean, how did you kind of pick which parts of the games to show in the documentary series? I mean, was it a case of like, you recorded 5 hours worth of gameplay footage and that was dumped on you, Connor, to pick the best bits, or how did that work?
Depends who's capturing the footage. Dan is incredibly, like, he covers all his bases. I get so much footage from Dan. I get, like a really solid amount, but, like, specific kind of stuff from Richard. And then Dom is like, you know, you get He's picked certain bits. He's like, this'll do for the dot points that we need to hit in the spreadsheet. This is what you need, you know? So depends who I get it from. But I think for the games that I'm familiar with, I kind of have a bit of a sense of, I can read between the lines of what Richard has sent through as a script and go, okay, I feel like I know what would go well here. I feel like I know what would go well here. For the stuff that I don't, that I have no experience with, I haven't played, or, you know, in some cases hadn't even heard of, I was completely unfamiliar with The Seventh Guest. It was a case of like watching all of the footage and try and use my instincts to the best of my ability. And then if there's anything where Richard's like, oh, there's actually a bit in this clip that would be banging here, I'll go back and rework it.
From a scripting point of view, deciding what to cover comes out of the interviews. And what we talk about in the interviews, of course, comes from my research and my instincts as a journalist and a historian. It's all about trying to put together a compelling story trying to represent what is the most interesting thing about this game. We're not trying to be complete. We don't want to be comprehensive. We've only got 5 to 10 minutes, sometimes even less, that we have to talk about this game because of the format that we're working in, where it's this more sort of magazine-y type format that where you're making a documentary that's covering lots of games. So we have to be selective. We can't cover every element of a game. It's way more interesting, I think, to be like, okay, for this game, we're going to explore the relationship between these two characters. Or we're going to explore how it tries to scare the player.
Yeah, I think like ultimately with the series as a whole, you know, we've only got so much time to cover all of these different subgenres of horror gaming and games within that. And I think it's structured really great, really well by Richard, where it we're able to use certain games as like a jumping off point for a topic to do with horror. It's not necessarily just about that game. It's about what that game did to move the needle for horror gaming, what that game does different or how that game scares in a different way to, you know, something that the games that were coming before it. And I think that's a really good way to cover as much ground as we can in the space that we've got, the time that we've got, you know.
So you mentioned earlier on 51 interviews. You know, 51 people were interviewed across the 5 episodes, which is absolutely huge. And, you know, some legendary people on there from film, you know, from music, and of course the video game industry. You know, you've got John Romero, John Carpenter, Corey Taylor from Slipknot, as well as, you know, an absolute huge amount of game developers. How did you process that? What was kind of like, how did you decide on all of these guests, and also how did you get a hold of some of them? Like, you know, people ask us on the Retro Hour, how did you get this guest? You go, oh, we just emailed them. Can you just email John Carpenter, for example, you know, a world famous director? How does that happen?
John Carpenter happens because our sister project is In Search of Darkness, which is a very successful franchise of gigantic 4 or 5, I think the latest one's like 6 hours, documentaries about horror movies in the 80s and the 90s. And so they had made contact with John Carpenter, probably through his agent initially, but they've interviewed him a bunch of times. So we were able to just piggyback on the latest interview that they were doing and, and throw in a segment of like 20, 25 minutes or something talking to him about video games, which apparently he was really excited about because he loves games.
Dude, it's great. In the raw footage where the interviewer says, "All right, well, now we're gonna pivot to video games," John Carpenter's like, "Yes! All right." Like, he sounds thrilled. And the first thing he says, and it's not in the documentary because there's nowhere to put it, but I want this on a record. I clapped and screamed when I heard it. The first thing he says, "The first video game I really loved was Sonic the Hedgehog." I stood up and I was like, "No way! Yes, dude."
That was such a good impression as well.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That was awesome.
The amount of content you've fit into these 5 episodes, it just sounds like, you know, you've really had to be selective with what's in there, but it sounds like you've got a really good overview of the genre as a whole. I mean, what do you kind of hope the audiences are going to take away from it, and what kind of lasting impact do you hope the documentary is going to have on the horror genre and gaming in general then, Richard?
I'd like to challenge people's views of what horror can be and to make people recognize that it's not just about like jump scares or body horror or titillation, which is what horror is sort of synonymous with these things now. But it's a horror is actually an umbrella term that covers all these different ideas. Like I remember at university studying a bit of gothic fiction, and it's all about the terror. And nowadays terror gets lumped in with horror, but it's a very different feeling actually. Horror is more... It's what comes after is how I've heard it described. It's like it's that feeling of disgust. It's that reaction. Terror is the foreboding. It's the sense that something is coming to get you, and you're terrified that this thing is gonna swallow you whole or whatever, and the ground is gonna come up and get you. So horror can be so many different things, and it's all about what makes you uneasy rather than just what gives you a kind of reaction. There's so much more to it. I want people to realize that and also to recognize that it can provide a catharsis. I mean, Dan is really passionate about this idea. You will have heard him when he was on the show. He's like, horror can save your life. He cares so much about it and believes so profoundly that it is a beautiful thing, as disgusting as it can sometimes be. It's a chance to just be a person, to just be yourself. Even like that's the cool thing about games is you're playing you. And you are confronting this difficult situation, this otherworldly kind of situation where you're fighting off zombies or something, and you are surviving on your wits, and you're an ordinary person. You don't have any special abilities, and so it's like it's telling you can be enough, whatever you're doing, and that's something we explore throughout the series, and I think that's a really powerful idea. I'd like people to come away recognizing that as well, that horror can really take you to a special place.
I'd really love for this thing to, in the same way that In Search of Darkness has its spot on my shelf as like a reassuring kind of totem for me as an aspiring, you know, filmmaker, I hope that this exists on the shelf of aspiring video game creatives or creatives of any kind to watch occasionally and shore themselves up and go like, okay, like I feel like an idiot for pursuing, you know, this creativity, pursuing this interest, but I'm not. There these guys did too, you know. Graham Devine, you know, and like thought he was a fool for pursuing full motion video for The Seventh Guest, but he made something really wonderful that resonated with people and meant a lot to him, you know. I hope that this kind of gives people the shot in the arm they need to keep going, you know, and just go like, okay, I'm not wasting my time, you know. I think that's something that a lot of the creative friends that I talk to worry about, and when they need it the most, it's stuff like this that gets them through those periods. I mean, even as I've been editing this thing, there's been times where I've really, again, this is the biggest project I've ever worked on, and there's been times where I've felt massive amounts of imposter syndrome and like, oh God, I have fooled people to get here and it's all going to come crashing down. They're going to figure it out, you know? And then I realized, wait, no, I'm working with footage of people, some people who I really, you know, look up to, saying the exact same things or grappling with the exact same things and doing so through their art. Like, okay, no, I'm on the right track. I hope that this can give other people that feeling as well, as well as just a greater appreciation for the genre and maybe titles that they haven't, given much time previously or whatever, or remind them of titles that they haven't thought of for years. And I think the cool thing about the reception to those first two episodes from people like yourself or you know, just people on social media and backers and press alike is that it is doing that. We've gotten heaps and heaps of responses from people saying, oh my God, this reminds me why I fell in love with this genre in the first place. You know, or just the other day, someone posted a photo of them watching it on a TV, I think in a hotel room or something, as they were about to give a lecture or like a talk on horror video games, and saying like, just watching this while I'm about to do this, and this has reminded me like why I love this in the first place. It's like, oh, that's awesome. It's already done what we wanted it to do, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there will be people listening who are like, you know, you've really whet their appetite for it. Obviously, you mentioned the backers there. How can people watch it though? Is there a way for just the general public to watch it?
Yeah, so you can go to, that's why people can understand the accents, terabytes.doc.com. Just try searching if you're having trouble.
I'll put it in the show notes as well. People can click through.
Yeah, run our accent through Google Translate and you'll get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you go there, you can order digital or you can get Blu-ray, and when you place your order, you get a preview version, but it's like 99.5% finished. It's like, it's basically done. Episodes 1 and 2, we've got a few fixes we've got to make. I might touch up the sound mix a bit, and we've got to add in the credits. And otherwise, they're done.
And by the end of April, the final 3 episodes will be sent out digitally, as well as the kind of final versions of episode 1 and 2.
Fantastic. Well, obviously, anyone listening to this can hear the passion that you guys have got for the genre. And it just feels like a real love letter to horror games. And, you know, Joe, he's the biggest horror game fan that I know. And if he tells me it's good, then I know it's going to be an incredible watch. So, best of luck with it, guys. And obviously, I'll link up the website in the show notes so people can click through. And thanks again for coming on and being our guest this week. And best of luck with it.
Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thank you.